from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We've got a big show ahead of us tonight. Of course, the Annie Leigh case has been big in the media. I sat down with Clint Van Zandt earlier today to get his perspective as a former FBI agent and security expert about this case. How important was DNA? How important is the evidence that the police have? And did the police do a good job? All right, we're back. One of our favorite guests here is Dr. Clint Van Zandt. You'll know Clint as a retired FBI agent, security expert, and someone who is well-versed when it comes to the idea of crime and what's in the minds of people like Raymond Clark and others who are out there. Hi, Clint. How are you?
Hey, good to be with you. Thank you.
Now, when we look at this whole case of Annie Leigh and Raymond Clark and the predator aspect of it, if that's what this is, I want to talk a little bit first, Clint, about your website, and you do have a DVD that you actually give away about how to protect people from predators. Let's talk about that.
We do. As you know, Dana, when I was seven, I was taken by a child predator, as I wrote about in my book, Facing Down Evil. But in my case, I was able to escape the predator. And as you know from your law enforcement work, many other children don't escape. Many become victims, sometimes permanent victims, unfortunately. So based upon my having been a victim as a child and then as an FBI agent investigating cases of child kidnapping and molestation, my last year as an FBI agent, I sat down with three different families, two of which had their missing person were children, and had to sit there and look in the eyes of these parents and tell them that their precious child would never come home again, that he or she had been kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and murdered by a child predator. So long story short, we put together at our own cost a DVD entitled Protecting Children from Predators. We give it away free on our website at livesecure.org, livesecure.org. And we've given away now going on 10,000. You and I were talking based upon an appearance a couple of weeks ago on Dr. Phil, and then a few times last week on the Today Show, where the DVD was shown. We've just had thousands of people come in. In fact, we just had to order another 5,000. I'm on Dr. Phil again this week talking about these type of cases. So the purpose we did this, and, you know, we charge shipping and handling because I'm not going to pay, I can't afford to pay the postage, but I can buy the DVD. And my whole purpose is if through that DVD we can educate people and they can share that with their children, if we can save a child for every one, every 10, every 100, I don't care.
Yeah.
If I can save a child from what I went through or from what the likes of the J.C. Dugards in the world have gone through, it's worth the money to me. And I'm sure, you know, for you in law enforcement, you and I do everything we can to try to, number one, put these predators away. That's why I've been such a strong advocate on a one-strike law for violent child molesters and predators. And number two, just to protect our children. They're our most precious investment in the future, and we've got to do everything to save them.
Yeah, for sure. And make sure folks check out Clint's website and look at getting that DVD. It's well worth it because it's education, education, education. We've talked about that many times. And, you know, the Dugard case is a good example of it. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Annie Leigh and Raymond Clark. Some are saying this is just a workplace violence gone wrong. Some would categorize Clark as a predator. Where did this go? How did this start?
Well, I think what we're going to find out, if we ever find out the truth, and again, we know that so many times, even though you have the offender, in this case the killer, number one, will he ever actually confess and tell us what he did? And number two, will he tell us why he did it? Number three, does he even know why he did it at the time? So I think that's going to be the challenge for law enforcement as they look at this. You know, I've read one article where it talked about it referred to this conflict that obviously took place, at least one-sided, between Ray Clark and Annie Lee, as did Worlds Collide. I mean, Annie Lee, you know, realized she was from a Vietnamese refugee family. She's in the States. She worked hard, kept her nose to the grindstone, got college scholarships, studied or worked in the lab 12 hours a day. She was on her way to do great things in cancer research. And, you know, just a wonderful, beautiful, articulate girl who was going to get married and who was just doing wonderful things while in her academic world. And there she is against her counterpart, a 24-year-old, just like her hometown boy, who basically had nothing going except playing baseball. He was a jock in high school. But as many people know, too, when he was in high school, he was accused by a former girlfriend of forcing sex on her. And then when she tried to break up, he went into a control rage. He was so upset about it. So I think there may be part of that, as this case plays out, Dana, where these two different worlds, where the hometown boy who was a high school graduate at best, who was going nowhere, his job was cleaning out rodent cages, and there's Annie Lee, the beautiful girl. She's got everything in the world going for her. She's going to be a doctor. She's going to be a celebrated person in the scientific community, and she was getting married soon. So he may have looked at her as somebody who had everything while he had nothing. And there are those people out there. Unfortunately, it becomes a sense of it deals with their personality. It deals with their sense of self-worth and self-esteem. And if you really feel challenged, and if any way, shape, or form you feel put down, it may not have even been by Annie Lee. It could have been by any combination of things that were going on in his environment at the time. But somehow it appears he chose to act out against her. And the question is right now, you know, why did he do it? I don't think there's going to be any question that he did it. I think that the law enforcement's ability to put him into this crime. Now, in old days, we would track somebody based upon footprints in the snow or footprints in the sand. In this case, they have electronic footprints where they can follow Ray Clark. They can put him in the same room that Annie Lee was in. They can put him in various rooms. They can put him in and out of the lab. The DNA, we've got her blood on his boots. We've got bloody gloves and bloody clothing. So I think the scientific evidence, the electronic evidence, that is going to a scientific certainty, say that Ray Clark, to the exclusion of anybody else in the world, is the murderer. But the question is, and it's the question that I think we look at every time, you know, what gives another person the right to put their hands, much less to kill another human being? How can you get that angry, that rageful, that frustrated, that you would face this 4'11", 90-pound woman, place your hands around her throat, and tighten and tighten and tighten and hold that for 1, 2, 3 minutes, perhaps, until you literally choke the life out of her?
Yeah, it's a question where, and I agree with you, the forensics are huge in this case. The why, we may never know, but, you know, Clint, as usual in cases like this, I shouldn't say usual, but it is common here most recently that the local cops are taking some heat about this case in the media.
Yeah.
Letting him go initially, trying to place the reason why this happened. Let's talk about that, the investigators and the scrutiny that they'll be under now.
Yeah, well, I think the challenge is even before they had any DNA, even before they had her body, they had the electronic ability to look at her key card and look at any other potential suspect's key card and say, who was she in a room alone with, and did that person leave the room? And if she didn't, that person was obviously the last one to see her alive in the world. In this case, that was Ray Clark. But, you know, part of the challenge was they didn't find her body, as you know, for multiple days. Yeah. She went missing, so to speak, on Tuesday, and her body wasn't found basically until her wedding day the following weekend, the day she was supposed to have gotten married. Now, police came in, they searched, they didn't find this metal electric locker. Evidently it was either locked or they didn't look inside, or they looked inside and he had jammed her body down in kind of a chimney-like opening where it just couldn't be seen. But somehow law enforcement, in their initial and subsequent searches, missed her body, didn't find it, and then what is challenging, I think, for some of us, too, is that even though that was the last place she was seen alive, they didn't declare that entire building a crime scene. They allowed people. I saw Yale students who were reporters on the newspaper saying they had been in the building. They had been in the labs. They had walked back and forth. Well, they allowed that to happen from the Tuesday she disappeared through the weekend when her body was finally found. And, you know, any defense attorney worth his salt is going to say, wait a minute, any physical evidence could well have been contaminated. The killer could have stashed the clothing. He could have got DNA from my client and put it someplace. You know, it by not closing off that crime scene, and you've got the local police department who's now handling the case and the FBI saying, wait a minute, that was a call of the Yale PD.
Yep.
They made the call to keep that crime scene wide open and keep that building wide open so other students could use it. Now, in their defense, they're saying, wait, she was gone. We assumed, which, you know, gets us in trouble, we assumed that she had been taken from the building, and therefore it was no longer a crime scene. So, you know, 20/20 hindsight is always great for us on the outside. Those on the inside have to live with these critical decisions. But we also know they brought cadaver dogs in initially and searched the lab, and we're told that because of the other animals in the lab, the rodents, the mice, the cats or dogs or whatever else was there, that the cadaver dogs were confused by the smells and didn't find her, unfortunately, until decomposition had really set in. I mean, the body was there, you know, 5 days at least. So that's when the cadaver dogs finally hit, and they finally found this girl's body. So I think there is a lot of criticism as far as how the crime scene was handled, how the search was conducted, and how her body was missed. And just one quick story, Dana, and let me flip this back to you. I remember as an FBI agent, we were working a kidnapping case in a northeastern part of the United States. A young boy had been kidnapped. And the FBI came in, and we were working with the local police department, and they absolutely positively guaranteed us they had searched. Now, it was a large apartment building. They said, we have been through every apartment. We've been through every level. That child's not there. Well, we did the profile, and we said, you know, this child was probably killed by a little bit older child, and it's not likely that that age group, this was, you know, the killer was probably 12 or 13, we said it's not likely somebody in that age group would have the ability to transport a body away from the crime scene. So we got to believe it's here someplace. So we went back in with the police and started searching. Now, this was 5 days later. And in the very basement of the building, tucked under stairs in a dark basement, was a lot of trash and junk and other things, as well as a relatively shiny black trash bag. And when we pulled that trash bag out, the victim was in there. And Dana, that the autopsy said that victim had lived for 4 days. So that little boy was in that bag, in that basement, under those stairs for 4 days before he finally died on the fifth day because of a bad search by law enforcement. That's how important that is. And that's how we all have to just realize we're going to get dirty and stinky when we do these searches. But like in that case, a life depended on it.
Yeah, and you're so right. Yeah, assumptions, laziness, sloppy police work turns into a case like you have or had or this case. Look at Michael Jackson. There's many of them. We can keep going on. And I guess something as investigators that we all know, Clint, is you always expect the unexpected, and you should remember that because it'll turn around and bite you on the butt. Where do you see this? Some are calling this case the crime of the century. I'm not sure about that. It's a tragedy, no doubt. But, you know, with your, you know, even with your DVD and predators and safety and workplace safety, where do you see this going as far as letting the people know and waking some people up as far as to how to protect yourself?
Well, I think, number one, we learned that, you know, there is no such thing as a safe environment. We know that murders and crimes of anger and rage take place in the big towns just like they do the small towns.
Yep.
And that, you know, you don't have to be a Ted Bundy serial killer. You can be a Ray Clark, you know, animal cage cleaner, and you're still fully capable of murder. And I, you know, part of it is that so many of the times we think of, when we try to think of reasons for murder, we think, well, somebody's jealous, so they're seeking revenge. I saw this one woman talking head on television, and she kept saying, there's got to be some relationship, some love relationship. He must have hit on her, and she didn't accept it. I say, well, you know, anything is possible. I mean, she could have been killed by a Martian, I guess. That's possible. But so many of these cases we see, you just wind up with an individual, just something like a rapist that you and I know is there for power, dominance, and control. Even though sex is an aspect of that crime, it's more a man trying to assert power, dominance, and control over a woman. And I think probably this is going to shake out somewhat the same, that for whatever Clark's reason, he didn't feel that he was given the proper respect. We know that he had this die-hard desire to stay within the protocol for taking care of rats and mice in the laboratory, and he had accused her of being a little bit slack on the protocol. So a combination of him feeling she wasn't following his rules, and then maybe feeling that he was supposed to be in control of that, and here's this little pipsqueak of a woman who's going to be a PhD and an MD soon, just kind of brushing him aside, that could have been enough for him to want some type of, to exert some type of control over her. And when he attempted to do that, we believe she fought back. We know there were scratches and things on him at the time. And when she fought back, I think that's when he said, how dare you, in his own mind. And that's when the hands tightened around the throat, and that's when that young woman lost her life. Would he take it back if he could? Sure. You know, you and I run into people who commit crimes all the time, and they say, gee, I want to take it back. I wish I hadn't done it. Well, homicide is one of those crimes that there are no take-backs in life. When you do it, that damage is done. And as much as people say, well, he was a nice guy, and he played softball, and he had a girlfriend, sure, he had all those things. But he also had that Jekyll Hyde aspect to his personality. And this combination of days and events and people and everything else, you know, I look at these crimes, Dana, and I say, why not yesterday? Why not tomorrow? Why not next month? Why not last month? You know, not only do I want to know what the motive is, but I want to know what the timing was. Why did it take place? Why did Joe, the Virginia Tech shooter, choose that day to go on that rampage and kill all those students? I mean, I was on that campus for a week, and I tried to wrap my head around that, and I still couldn't get the answer, because so many times these questions just don't have answers, at least not answers that reasonable people like, you know, your listeners and you want to hear.
Yeah, exactly. There's no answers why, but we see the tragic results of why it happened. So we just can't put a pin on exactly the reason being. And we can try and we can talk about it, Clint, but I guess my last question for you is whether it's Cho or Clark or whoever, we're going to continue having these sorts of tragedies in society, these sorts of crimes that will continue. And I know I always ask this question of my guests, but the media coverage, you look at both sides. Has the media coverage been fair in this case of Annie Lee?
Well, I think the coverage is fair in a way, but the problem is, of course, now we have 24/7 cable, and then the cable networks compete against each other. I mean, realize, though, I mean, I probably did the Annie Lee story 5 times on the Today Show. I mean, there are 9, 12 million people who watch that every morning. And, you know, for a major show like that to be running it, notwithstanding the tabloid-like cable channels who just revel in someone else's misery and look forward to a death because it'll get their ratings up. That's what bothers me, is that these tragedies in life are hashed and rehashed and rehashed over and over on cable television at night. And when I see people pretend like they really care, Dana, I don't believe it. I really don't believe it. I think the vast majority of these people I see running with these stories, number one, they've never been on the street like you and some of your listeners. They've never found a dead body. They've never had to make a decision whether they're going to kill somebody or not. They've never investigated a homicide. They've been nice and clean in the newsroom. Or if they're a prosecutor, they see it after the fact. They've never been there. They've never got blood on their own shoes. And until you do that, until you do that, I don't think you have a real true appreciation for what actual human misery is. And I think too many news people see this as just one more story that they can run with, that it's got, as they say in the media, legs on it, that the story's going to last for a while. There's, you know, that all the audiences out there vicariously will say, oh, here's another beautiful, smart woman killed by, a terrible, nasty man. And, I mean, some people are saying this is a war on women by men. Well, men kill women. Men are physically stronger than women. Men want power, dominance, and control, and it's been like that since a caveman hit a woman in the head with a club.
Yep.
And that's the cut. Should it be different? Hell yes, it should be. But it's not. Will we continue to see these stories? Yes, we will, because it's in our human nature. We have a choice, and our choice is to do good or evil. And unfortunately, there's a significant number of people, even though we say sociopaths, psychopaths, antisocial personalities, that represents 2 to 4% of the population of any people group. Well, in the United States, with 310 million people, do the math. 2 to 4% are people who are either fully capable of being captains of industry or accounting and steal millions, if not billions, of dollars. Are they capable of going into a lab and wrapping their hands around a woman who had everything to live for and choke the life out of her because they felt their life was on out of control, so they were going to gain control somehow by taking another person's life?
Well said. Thank you, Clint.
Thanks, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Clint Van Zandt. You know him as a retired FBI agent and security expert, and always welcome on the program. Make sure and check out his webpage at livesecure.org and order that DVD. That's one that you should check out. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You'll recognize my next two guests, Robin Sachs and Stacey Dietrich, two regular contributors to the Justice Interrupted radio show, to the Women in Crime blog. They're both television commentators, authors. In fact, I think they're auditioning for one of those housewife shows, aren't you?
I'm sorry.
I'm here.
Nothing. I didn't want you to hear that anyway.
Oh, okay.
It's supposed to be funny, but it failed miserably, so.
Oh, you never fail miserably.
No.
You were cutting out, so I didn't get the whole joke.
I said the two of you are auditioning for one of those housewife shows, I think, aren't you?
Oh, stop it right now.
What a nightmare.
You know, I can't say I've ever watched one, but, the good work that you've done with Justice Interrupted and the Women in Crime blog and all the TV work and the authoring and everything that you've done, when do you have time to actually sit down with your families and be moms?
Oh, hey, what an interesting factoid that you bring up at this very moment.
You don't even want to know.
Oh.
I'm actually out here in L.A. with Robin.
Yes.
And spent, I think, how long was it last night, Robin, as a train wreck in tears because my 7-year-old was having a meltdown over the fact that I'm gone again.
Uh-oh.
So it's difficult, to say the very least.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Oh, bad.
And you try to explain to a 7-year-old that, hey, mommy's doing this for you so mm-hmm. you can have those American Girl dolls and you can have a great Christmas and we have a nice house and... You know, what do you say when the 7-year-old says, I don't care about that, I just want you to come home?
Yep.
And it's heart-wrenching.
No, I understand. And Robin Sachs, as a former DA and someone who's on the run all the time, I think it's very rare for me to actually interview you from your home. You're never home. And that's something that's, even my kids growing up with their dad as a policeman, it's tough because you're not there, but it's something that we still do. How do you balance the two, Robin?
Well, and I think the key word is the word balance, and Stacey brings it up so aptly. I mean, we just sat here lamenting for the last 45 minutes on, what do you do this for, and what's the message? And yes, and Stacey knows, and you know, none of us who are in the business of crime are doing it for any kind of great home in the Hamptons or any huge vacations
and far from
and Capri or any European vacations anytime soon. I mean, you're doing this so that you can barely scrub by yourself, but really because you feel very passionate about what you're doing.
I
think the thing that we try to impress upon our kids, and when you're looking at this, is listen, we're doing something that matters. We're setting an example that you speak up when you feel that there are injustices. We're a role model. And the other thing is that we're women. You know, this is a really weird, hard spot. I mean, you go into work, Dana, as
yep.
much as I love you and you know you have the balancing act to do, it's not as freaking hard as it is for us. I'm sorry. It's harder. It's harder being the mama bear
yep.
And being the one who's out there who's doing this kind of stuff when the perception still very much exists that we don't have to do it.
Yeah, I agree.
And we hope that we're just being good role models to our kids.
I agree totally. It's not being sexist. It's just telling the truth. Anyway, we'll talk about our private lives on air here a little bit later, but no, actually, we won't. There's been a lot of crime to talk about here since I've had you both on the show, even Robin, just last week. And one of the big cases, some are saying in the media, Stacey, that it's the crime of the century. I'm not sure about that, but the Annie Lay case is a tragedy for sure. And from the police perspective, I want to talk to you a little bit about the local cops. The Yale cops are going to come under some scrutiny, deservedly so, I think, in a couple of cases or a couple of things that they did or didn't do. But let's talk about this case in particular and high-profile cases and why the police are put under the microscope. You and I know the answer, but tell my listeners.
Well, I don't know that I would necessarily classify Annie Lay as the crime of the century. J.C. Dugard, Sandra Cantu, yes,
yeah.
Not Annie Lay.
Right.
And the reason being is, unfortunately, there are occurrences of that happening that don't necessarily make the media. And when it comes to the law enforcement under scrutiny in that case, and I think one of the biggest issues was not shutting down the building.
Yeah.
And allowing that to be entered and walked through and whatnot. And I do take a little bit of contention with these accusations, only because you have these videos of this surveillance videos of a woman entering a building. They scour the videos and don't see her coming out.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that, you know, they did an initial walkthrough. And, you know, of course, common sense is if she didn't walk out, you know, maybe she was put out in the garbage, in a, you know, some type of container where they wouldn't necessarily see, but that she was somehow out of that building, which is actually a logical thought process as far as law enforcement goes. I think when you're dealing with law enforcement like Yale Police, your last, and I'm not dogging on Yale Police as far as experience, but logically for them, you know, not necessarily dealing with many cases. And frankly, Dana, law enforcement agencies across the country, if they do a walkthrough of the building, they're checking rooms, they're checking closets, she's nowhere to be found. You know, who's to think that she's buried in a square foot cable access in the wall?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, seriously, and people can say, well, how could you not search, you know, we're human beings, and let's be logical about this. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And it's very unfortunate, but I think to, at this point, turn around and lambay the law enforcement agency is a little premature.
Yeah, there's only one person to blame here, and it's the person who's charged for the alleged crime. Robin, when you get a case like this and you see some media coverage lambasting the cops, or you wonder why wasn't the crime scene secured, all that sort of stuff, I know you've got to, you can't, well, maybe you do, go and have a little cry and then go do your work, but you got to work with what you have. I've heard some in the media saying that this is the perfect case for the DA, but I'm not sure if there's ever a perfect case, is there?
Well, you know, and looking at this, and when I look at a case like this, it's always very easy for all of us here in the media, now I got to throw on the media hat as opposed to the prosecutor hat, for us to look at this and play Monday morning quarterback and talk about all the things we would do differently if we were in the driver's seat and what, you know, if it was a perfect storm, how we would investigate, prosecute, frankly, background check this guy if we were the employers and all this other kind of stuff in terms of the case itself. So you deal with the hand you're dealt. Frankly, there are unfortunate things that happen in this happens in this case, but the reality is that there are unfortunate things that happen in every single case. And if we all go in with under a microscope and we look at it, we can easily point to things that if we were, you know, judge, jury, lawmaker, law enforcement, to what we would do differently. I guess the thing is that this is a summer of what I call the missed opportunity summer, because I'm borrowing from the words of the sheriff's department up in police department up in Antioch and the parole when they talked about all the missed opportunities in the Garrido case.
Yep.
And so I feel bad for the Yale police department, because now they're being heavily scrutinized, probably more so than ever, because of some serious mishaps that have happened in other cases. But things in this case, you know, frankly, they found the suspect, they found the victim. The guy who did it is the person who's responsible for the murder. And it's really not a law enforcement blunder here in my mind. This is a blunder with Yale. Why was this guy, who was accused of a sexual assault when he was in high school, whether there were charges that were filed or not filed, whether, you know, why is that background check not being done? This kind of falls more along the lines of the Jasmine Fiore, Ryan Jenkins case of the people who are in the private sector. You know, you almost understand people in law enforcement in the public sector who are so bogged down with caseloads, so bogged down with budgets, so bogged down with all these other things. But what about schools like Yale that get hundreds and thousands of dollars of donations and all kinds of money rolling around that place to be able to do the proper background check to make sure that the schools that they're, you know, that their private school kids are in are being protected?
Yep, you're right. If you're just tuning in, Robin Sachs and Stacey Dietrich are here. Stacey, the other case we're talking about, Garrido and the Dugard case, and had a lot of scrutiny there, law enforcement coming back and saying, yeah, we blew it, we made mistakes. I don't batter them as much as most in the media do, because they were going looking for certain things. But then again, it's a whole system. This young girl had two children. There's health involved. There's social services. There's protective services. There's probation, parole, all sorts of things. You can't just blame the cops, can you?
No, and actually out of this whole thing, if we have to have that one thing to blame, I'm going to point my finger not at the deputy that showed up, not at the sheriff's office, not at the neighbors or the people. I am going to point my finger at parole.
Yep.
And the only reason is it started with the failure of the parole board initially that allowed this man to get out. And I'm going to cite the case of my own hometown horrific case of Kristen Jackson, Joel Yockey, who had a 25-year-to-life sentence for kidnapping and raping a 15-year-old back in, I believe it was 04, was released. He, according to the parole board, was rehabilitated. This was a dangerous man, a crazy man. He was out for 2 weeks, abducts 14-year-old Kristen Jackson from a county fair in Wayne County, Worcester, Ohio, dismembers her body within 2 weeks of his release. And who is accountable for that? And that is very similar in the J.C. Dugard case. And I take issue probably the most with the parole officer as well, only because my own parole officers in my own jurisdiction, they are just bulldogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I praise them to the highest levels. I have gone out where they check their sex offenders, literally walk in their homes, are turning things upside down. They're looking, they're doing their jobs, they're in there, you're a sex offender, I'm checking, they're in there checking for any evidence whatsoever that this man is reoffending. And that particular parole officer for 18 years, it's my understanding, never did that.
I'm with you. I agree. Touche.
And that, I have to say, I take the biggest issue, only because I know these people, I see the people that actually do the job they're supposed to do, and this man, this one parole officer, failed, and quite frankly, should lose his job. And, you know, I am a huge advocate of law enforcement, obviously, and it's very rare for me to, you know, point fingers at another law enforcement officer, but this person failed. He failed the community. He failed J.C. Dugard. He failed her family. and he should be held accountable for that.
I couldn't agree more. Robin, another thing that should be under more scrutiny is the so-called sex offender reporting registry, whatever you want to call it. It's good to have it, but it's just not working the way that it should, or am I wrong?
Well, that's the biggest unfortunate unintended consequence that the parole officer in this case and anyone else involved in the Gerudo case has caused, because now all we have done with this case is added steam to all those reform sex offender law people, RSOL people out there, and they know who they are because those are the people who come and blog about me, write about me, and campaign against me in terms of trying to protect sex offenders. And all of a sudden, now you have a case like this, and they say, now there's a serious egg on your face, law enforcement, serious egg on your face, prosecutor, serious egg on your face, lobbyists and politicians, because what good is a sex offender registry if you can't monitor the worst of the worst?
Right.
And now, if you're saying that it's here to monitor, well, it's really not, because no one's being monitored. Instead, what's happening is all it is serving as some sort of consequence that's meant to ostracize people in communities, and all it is meant to do is to have a punitive effect. And what do you say to that, that when they're not monitoring and doing what the exact the list is intending to do? So it undermines the list, which creates huge problems for all of the rest of us out here who expect these lists to be not only monitored, but be complete and informed and have information that we can use to be able to make sure that the people who are the worst of the worst are being watched under the lawful eye. And no one, the sex offender rights people, nor law enforcement, nor ourselves, wants to take this monitoring duty on our own. But what else do you say when that's what's being forced to happen? So this is what I call an unintended consequence. It's an unfortunate and awful thing that now we all have to sit here and say, well, it's still important to have sex offender registry lists, and it's hard to point to the facts to show why it's so great when you have a case as atrocious as this.
Yep, needs to be reviewed for sure. Stacey Dietrich, what are you up to? I know those of you that like to follow Stacey, read her books, are wondering if she's working on a new project, and I think that's exactly what you're doing.
Well, actually, I'm out here with Miss Robin, just, you know, experiencing 2 days of her craziness. I'm very tired. And we, you know, Justice Interrupted Radio, we're actually, you know, working with many wonderful people here in Los Angeles to develop that into a television show. I am leaving tomorrow morning to head up north to San Francisco, where I am working on the Sandra Cantu book.
Yep.
I will be attending Melissa Huckabee. As you know, the last trial, the prosecutor came out and finally announced that they were, in fact, seeking the death penalty against Melissa Huckabee. I will be attending the hearing Friday, which I believe they're going to try and hash out a court date. I know there's some extreme tension between the defense and the DA's office as far as when this trial will actually go forward. There's some pretty unique and interesting facts about this case, I think, that aren't necessarily public knowledge. It's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds. So I think everybody really needs to keep a watch on this.
And you're the one.
Stacey's doing an amazing job. She's not just going and flying in at 11th hour to just go watch a little bit of, I have to do some shameless self-promoting for my friend here, because she's not just going and watching a little bit of a clip on television or watching, going and showing up for, you know, 1 day of a hearing, which is Friday. She's flying up tomorrow, and she has 2 days of pre-interviews with people involved in the case. She has ins and outs and secrets about this case that even I didn't know, that you don't know, Dana, none of which that I'm at liberty to share. She hasn't even shared everything. But she's going to have some wowzers that are going to come out in this book that are going to knock people's socks off. And only someone like Stacey, who is both kind, a passionate advocate on behalf of victims, and someone who has every best interest at heart, she's the perfect person to write this book. And I'm honored to have kind of heard little bits here and there.
Well, absolutely.
This is why I love Robin Sachs so much.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's that to be a good author, you need to be a good investigator, and you both are excellent at that. Robin, I'm going to ask you the last question. Michael Jackson has slowed down a little bit. We still get bits and pieces in the media. But what reared its ugly head today was Anna Nicole, and we're hearing some tragedies in behind that case as far as, again, enablers and drugs and thousands of prescriptions and all that sort of stuff. What do you think both of these cases are going to do as far as the prescription drug aspect, the medical aspect involving the death of, and it's taken a couple celebrities, but the medical system in itself and the over-prescribing of narcotics?
Was that a question for Robin?
That's a question for Robin. You're having a hard time hearing
living
me.
Living in the heartland of the drug capital, or the prescription drug capital of the country, Los Angeles here, I think that the Dr. Feelgoods are pooping in their pants. I mean, that's my rated PG-13 version of what I really want to say.
But
I feel and see a concern, a general concern for people all over the city in terms of what does this mean for me? Because all of a sudden, you know, here, and I actually feel bad for Dr. Conrad Murray, despite the fact that I think he's facing a lot of problems, and I can sit here and analyze his case, and I can sit here and look at it. And I feel bad because he was the man with the last, you know, the last guy standing with the bag in his hands, and he died. You know, Michael Jackson died on his watch, and it could have been anybody, frankly. And you know, you sit here and you go, who would have thought that this was going to happen? But I'll tell you, I got a call from a good friend of mine from law school last night, who said to me, "So, what's up with Arnie Klein?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, well, we represent him not in this Michael Jackson stuff, but we represent him in everything else. What's going on over there?" And, you know, it's really there is going to be a change in what goes on here. And the only thing that will be unfortunate is in terms of the reputation of the Los Angeles County DA's office and the LAPD is if they only take these two celebrity cases and don't then filter this down to the regular everyday folks. As you know, at Justice Interrupted, we talk about the everyday folks that are affected by crime and where justice has interrupted their lives. And it would be a travesty for the people who overdose, who abuse drugs, who have their Dr. Feelgood, who aren't a celebrity, and no one gives a damn to say anything or do anything.
Yep, I agree. And I got to apologize, gals. I think you're having a hard time hearing me. I'm not having a hard time hearing you, but we'll work that out next. That's Robin Sachs and Stacey Dietrich. Listen to them.
Technical difficulties, but I'll blame it on Canada.
I know. Dana, can I just add something really quickly to this?
Yes, absolutely.
Our dear friend, crime writer Donna Kaufman, who co-authored the book on Anna Nicole Smith with
Sarah Wecht.
Yes, thank you. Forensic pathologist here, what?
Lawyer, too.
They actually broke the story with the pharmaceutical suicide, and there are some extremely interesting details with Anna Nicole and this whole drug abuse thing that really I don't think people know about. And
she's amazing, and you should have her on as a guest.
Yeah, I mean, she actually, the stuff that came out when she was investigating this case is phenomenal, and they're the ones that actually found out about this whole pharmaceutical black market type thing with Anna Nicole Smith. So it's really, I think everybody, this is terrible, the name of the book escapes me, but everybody should pick it up because that's the real end.
Well, I've actually picked the book up.
Great ad there, Susan.
Yeah. Hey, no, you know what, the book is actually in my hand as we speak. It's called A Question of Murder.
Thank you, Dana.
It's Dr. Sarah Wecht and Donna Kaufman, who are semi-regular guests on the program.
You need to tell them that I plugged her book.
You need to tell them that Dana is nothing but the fact.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, you take care, Dana.
Take
good
care.
Night.
Bye-bye. That's Stacey Dietrich and Robin Sachs from Justice Interrupted Radio. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I sat down today to get another perspective of the Annie Lay case with a criminal profiler to talk about how do you sit down and profile a case like this. And you know Pat Brown from Pat Brown Profiling. Here's Pat. All right, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. You'll know Pat Brown as a criminal profiler, a semi-regular guest on Nancy Grace, Larry King, and I hear she's going to be on Dancing with the Stars here very soon. She's on TV.
Don't I wish, David. I don't think I'm going to be quite qualified for
Well,
that.
I hear you're quite the dancer. But anyway, that's another story for another show sometime. What brought my attention to Pat Brown is her fine work and her fine article on the Women in Crime blog about the Annie Lee tragedy. You know, we can all sit and look back. The Yale cops, and in my opinion, the Yale police dropped the ball with this again. It seems like sloppy police work, maybe laziness, resulted in some questions that may come up, whether it's crime scene contamination by letting these kids walk all around the place, in my opinion, to maybe just some sloppy searches. I don't know. That's my opinion. I'm a huge proponent of law enforcement, obviously, because I am law enforcement. But their comment, and I have to agree with my next guest here, Pat Brown, as far as workplace violence, is just totally off the wall, and they're out to lunch on that one. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how you doing, Dana? You know, one of the things about the workplace violence that kind of makes me sort of angry is because, I saw this email. It came in the other day. I thought it was kind of fascinating. They said it's because that the people have such different statuses at this workplace. Over at Yale, you have these PhDs, and they're the important people. And then you have these guys who are cleaning the cages, and just levels of the society that causes anger.
No.
I thought to myself, wait a minute. Does that mean that all the secretaries who've been working in firms for years should kill their bosses?
Yeah.
Or how about, hey, people who come with, how about the housekeeper? Should she kill all the people that she cleans houses for? I mean, our society everywhere in the world has different strata. It's just the way life is. We're all in a different place, and I know a lot of people make a whole lot more money than me.
Mm-hmm.
I should go off and, you know, kill them all because it makes me feel bad?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think so. And the guy that comes over to till up my garden or do some yard work for me, I got to watch and make sure he's not carrying a machete in his hand or something, and he's going to come after me because I don't pay him enough. That's crazy.
Exactly.
Now, that does
happen to some extent. I mean,
sure.
We do see the fact that sometimes what happens is most of the people in these jobs are lovely people, you know, because, I mean, they are lovely people. We have, you know, wonderful housekeepers and maintenance men and security guards,
yep.
A lot of great people. But sometimes in a job that doesn't require a lot of entrance, you know, it doesn't have high entrance requirements. In other words, you don't have a lot of education. You may not even need to speak the language. You may be able to get the job if you're just breathing. This is what happens with a lot of security work, which is why it attracts serial killers. You know, it just doesn't take a lot to get the job. So among the really nice people, you get the people who just get the job. And those are people who are, shall we say, losers.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't done well in life, and they're angry about it. Those are the psychopaths who can slither in to this level of work. So there is probably a higher incidence of scary people at certain levels, only because they are unable to move up into higher level jobs because of their personalities being, you know, kind of creepy, and maybe they don't have the wherewithal to, you know, to work hard to get that to that point. So among people who are just solid working citizens, we have those psychopaths who are running around, and they will have resentment against people who are better than them, as they quote put it, you know,
mm-hmm.
think they're better than them. And it just means that the people are, you know, they've had different opportunities and perhaps worked hard at certain opportunities, but a psychopath will say they should have had it, and these other people don't deserve it, and they're looking down on them, even if they're not. So, you know, just because it's Yale doesn't mean that people who work at Yale who work in the lab are all creepy, crazy people like this. You're going to kill everyone.
Mm-hmm.
There's just one of them. And unfortunately, Annie Lee got stuck in the middle of it.
Yeah, exactly. Pat Brown is here, a criminal profiler. Some of the reports I've seen in the media, Pat, say that this is the perfect case. Yeah, there's some good forensics here. I'm not sure if Clark's speaking or not or talking. We'll confess any defense lawyer worth his salt will challenge it anyway. There's some slip-ups by the Yale police that may cause a problem. But let's look at this from the perspective of some will say that it's a crime of the century. I'm not sure about that. A tragedy for sure, but how the media have been portraying this case, it's sad. But the crime of the century, I don't think so.
Well, I think it's one of the stupidest crimes of the century I've ever seen. I mean, that's one of the reasons this guy will be probably put away.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think he thought this crime through. I don't think he premeditated it. I think he had an issue, you know, with power and control. He targeted Annie Lay.
Mm-hmm.
My belief is it's not just about the fact she didn't clean those mouse cages well enough. I'm sure there's lots of other people there who don't clean to his standards as well, probably males. And he might have also had a thing for her because she was the beautiful, perfect girl, and he may have been watching her, thinking about her, fantasizing. And since he
hooked up with an Asian club back in high school. I'm kind of thinking that might be, you know, he'd been looking for girls back there that were Asian. And so this is where he enacted his crime. I think he did a ruse to get her in there. Yeah. And during that, after that ruse, which is just his excuse to get near her and try to push himself on her and show her who's boss and show her why she's missing something by marrying that other dude, you know, I think he did become enraged and committed a crime he probably hadn't planned, you know, planned out before they ended up in the room together. So it's not premeditated in that sense, but certainly once he decided she wasn't doing his bidding, whatever way it was, and he wanted to show her who was boss, at that moment, that's when that crime occurs. There is a premeditation at that moment that he wants to commit that crime. And all the evidence is so, so heavy against him that there's no question he's going to jail. Mm-hmm. I think the only problem is going to be that a defense attorney is going to say, and this is what makes me really ill, that it really wasn't premeditated, that he was just trying to be helpful and help Annie lay out. And she came to the lab, and she started being nasty to him, and he got upset, and then she attacked him.
Yeah.
That's why he's got scratches on him. She attacked him, and he had to defend himself. Mm-hmm. And it might put enough doubt in the jury's mind that they may at least think that he has it's manslaughter or second-degree murder or something less reasonable than what should be, which is first degree. Mm-hmm. That's what concerns me, is they'll get it down a notch, and then he'll get back out again.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree with you. All we have to do is look at the Dugard case as far as someone who shouldn't have been out. The other problem is the state that this happened in, Connecticut, is as weak-kneed as you can get. And if they come forward with a plea deal, this guy might be roaming the streets sooner than we think. I hope not. Your thoughts?
Exactly. That's what concerns me. I think when I saw the tide turning to this being workplace violence, that's what started getting me worried.
Yeah.
That if people just looked at this guy as a violent psychopath who targeted an innocent woman and brutally murdered her, we got no problem here. We've got first-degree murder. But when you start trying to play the victim in there and say, oh, look, she was involved, they were having an issue at the workplace, you're starting to equalize the territory there and make him not so bad anymore. He just snapped, the old snapped word. He just snapped and lost control, and she contributed to that. And then the jury, I'm seeing people going for the story. They're not thinking it's anti-women or a psychopath who can't handle, you know, people standing up to him. They're thinking, wow, you know, she must have been snotty and tacky and, you know, really pushed his buttons, and he lost it.
Yeah.
And I can see how I would do it. Look how he was obviously didn't plan it well, because look, he was obviously stuck with a body. He couldn't have planned it. And then he freaked out, and they're showing him his head in his hands, and he's completely panicked, and his face is white, you know. He's all, you know, terrified. Wow, we can relate to that. And that's what concerns me. They can be able to convince a jury that this is really a nice guy who just lost it, and therefore he won't get first degree.
Yeah, you know, the criminal justice system is a show all on its own. I want to end up with you, Pat, as far as how the media have been portraying this sad crime. They've tried to throw a predatory aspect to it, be careful whatever elevator you get on, or the, you know, when you're sitting at your desk working at your workplace, the person in the next cubicle could be planning to kill you tomorrow aspect of it, and, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And we're not trying to say that there isn't predators out there and you shouldn't be careful, but I think they're overblowing that part of it a little bit, or am I wrong?
Well, I kind of think that women are getting into more and more precarious positions by the day. I think there is a rise in psychopathy, both the male and female. But what happens when you have a rise in male psychopathy is there's always a tendency to you try to find a group you can assault, essentially.
Right.
You know, somebody that you can, win. So if you're a male psychopath, you just can't beat out the guys that are, you know, your size. And you can't focus on them because you can't beat them. So what you do is you drop down a notch. You say, okay, these women are smaller than me. You know, they're more handleable. I don't know how you say that word, handleable. I can manage those ladies.
Yeah.
And besides which, our society still tells men, and I got emails on this one too, the reason a lot of us guys like Asian girls now is because they're not like the rest of the girls in this country who think that they're going to compete against men all the time, and they just have the jobs out in society. These women, Asian women, this is what the psychopath talking, mind you, not me.
Yeah.
Asian women will stay home and have your babies and have sex with you and bring you your beer.
Yeah.
You know, the other women won't. So there's this rage against women who are competing in the workplace, rage against women who are standing on their own two feet, not from healthy men, but from psychopathic men.
Right.
So I think since we're seeing a rise in psychopathy across the board, women are in danger of this. So when you're at the health club, some guy eyes you and says, why can't I get a girl like that? When you're working at a workplace, when you're living next door to somebody, and this is constant anger against women who are successful and who are saying no, like there's some kind of entitlement that if I want that woman, I should get her. She doesn't have any rights. That's a problem. It really is out there, and that's why we're seeing this kind of violence against women in the home with people, with boyfriends and husbands, and outside of the home as well, in workplaces and in, just out in society. But it's not one place in particular. Mm-hmm. Women have to be kind of cautious about who they hook up with, who they spend time talking to, and keep their eyes open for people who have issues like this. And I don't think Annie Lay saw it coming. Mm-hmm. I think she was just a sweet, friendly girl who probably never realized this guy had issues with her.
Yeah.
Until it was too late. And then she said, What do you mean you're having a problem with me?
Yeah.
But he's going to look for that person to build himself up. And at the moment of killing her, he finally gets to win. He thinks, this girl who thought she was all that is not all that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I beat her.
No, I agree with you. And it's... Women need to look for the signs, watch for the controlling signals, watch for the dominant signals, and be prepared. I'm not sure, obviously the violence against women is what I call an epidemic across North America, and some of these psychopaths out there, you're right, with the Asian aspect of it, they think that the Asian gals are more compliant and will do as they say and sit back and be quiet, and that's wrong, and they certainly need to look for the signs and be careful, protect.
Right, and I'm sure there's a lot of Asian women who would laugh about that particular theory about them too.
Yep.
This is just coming from these men who've decided,
yep,
oh, I'm going to go to a new population to dominate, and they think this is the new one out there for them. And that's been, it's been around for quite a while. But yes, women have to be careful who they get involved with, and they have to keep their eyes out. It end up being, when you're away from the herd, you're alone, you're in danger sometimes. And being down in a basement if nobody's around is not a safe place to be if you got one of these black jobs next to you.
Yep, I agree with you. It's always best to be careful. Thank you, Pat.
And thanks a lot, Dana.
You take care. Bye-bye. Always be safe. Be careful. Look for the signs. Don't panic. But I think it's important that if you think someone is stalking you, harassing you, doing something that may be a problem in the future or very soon, contact your authorities. Don't try and approach the person and deal with it yourself. Going to a website like Pat Brown's or Clint Van Zandt's and looking at some of the safety tips and talking about some of the safety tips that they have there or what we have on the show or others is so important, it may save your life. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. And we are right back, and I want to thank my guests this evening, Stacy Dietrich, Robin Sachs, Clint Van Zandt, and Pat Brown for joining us on tonight's program. Remember, our website is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. We'll see you again here real soon on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.